If a magazine can be considered the reflection of one man, Norman Cousins and Saturday Review are the inseparable counterparts of a single image. His entire adult life from the age of 25 has been devoted to this lively literary journal of thought and opinion as executive editor, editor-in-chief, sometime owner, but never less than the dominant force that shaped its personality and character during the 30-odd years of its greatest growth. Norman Cousins' driving commitment to world peace and order and the preservation of the human species from its own destruction have filled the editorial columns of the magazine, ruled his public and private life, and are the subjects of his several books, including Who Speaks for a Man and Is Modern Man Obsolete? Norman, a couple of years ago, when the Saturday Review was changing ownership and you resigned as editor, you described the situation as a test of whether a magazine is a property or a living thing. In what sense is a magazine a living thing?
It has to grow. That's the first sign that it is a living thing. But it has to grow in a certain environment. It has to be part of the lives of its readers. It has to grow with them. They have to grow with it. And it's hard to regard a magazine or to treat it as though it were merchandise, something that comes out of a vending machine. And then, too, since a magazine is concerned with ideas, it represents the things that are closest to you. In that sense, of course, it is more than...
Well, Saturday Review has always had a rather special relationship with its readers. Did you set out to build that relationship? It's almost like a family.
Well, that's the thing that gives me the greatest joy in the magazine. At night, after the office clears out, I like to go through the mail from readers, many of whom wear their hearts on their sleeves, who have some very interesting things to say, not just about the magazine, but about life in general or about their own problems. And sometimes I'll pick up the telephone and call some of our readers in different parts of the
really?
Country
mm-hmm.
just to chat with them about this. And over the years, you do develop this relationship. I think I've been lucky. I think I've probably had more love affairs than any man in the world. Mm. And they're all with the readers of this magazine.
So you did set out to build this special relationship over the years that you were the
I don't think I did it with malice aforethought, but it certainly gave me a great deal of satisfaction as it developed. Hmm.
Why do some magazines live, thrive, and some magazines die?
I don't know. By this time, I suppose there ought to be enough evidence to indicate why magazines die. On the structural side, the business side, I've got some hunches about that if you'd like to hear them,
sure.
Jim. Now, this has nothing to do with the editorial content of a magazine, which, of course, is of critical importance. But just on the business side, there's something basically unworkable about a magazine, or about most magazines, which is that it is sold to the reader for less than the cost of manufacture.
The advertising paying the difference.
Yes, but what the advertiser, increasingly over the years, has had to pay an increasingly large a larger part of the difference. At one time, the advertiser, let's say, might have paid 55% of the cost of a magazine product. But today, he's expected to pay upwards of 80% of the total cost of a magazine. And this is unworkable and unrealistic.
Well, is it equally workable that the reader pay the full cost? Because that would be a pretty high cost, wouldn't it?
No, I don't think the reader should pay the full cost, but I think you ought to have a balance, perhaps something in the vicinity of 50-50 or 55-45. The great gamble that we took was to try to run a magazine without cut-rate introductory offers, which are standard in the industry. And it was my feeling that unless we could do this, we would have the same difficulties that most magazines are in.
So you get more readers and getting less money.
Yes, and we perhaps are not aiming for as many readers as Life magazine did. We may have a few number of readers, but I think that we can establish a genuine relationship with these readers. And if we put out a magazine that wins their respect, perhaps we may have their support.
Mm-hmm. Norman, you started out in life in New Jersey with the idea that you might become a baseball player.
Did you pick that up too somewhere?
Yes.
Well, it's mostly a fiction. I can tell you how the fiction started. When Harrison Smith, the publisher of the Sad Review, was trying to reach me, to hire me for the Sad Review, he tried to get me in various places and learned that I was playing baseball at Yankee Stadium. It was true, I was playing baseball at Yankee Stadium, but it was with the Metropolitan Newspaper League. Mm-hmm. And the newspapers at that time had their baseball teams, and that's how I happened to be playing at the Yankee Stadium. We'd play at the big league ballparks when they were on the road. I was not, have never aspired to, and had no...
Didn't you play baseball as a youngster?
Oh, yes.
But seriously?
Yes, mm-hmm. I did. Mm-hmm.
So you must have had aspired to do something with that baseball.
Oh, yes, I am. From the age of 7 to 9, I suppose, like most boys, I wanted to be president of the United States. And from the age of 9 to about 15, I wanted to be a big league baseball player. Mm-hmm. And
did anything happen to stop that?
Well, at the age of 19, I was playing shortstop, and we were in a game that was pretty close, and the batter hit a Texas leaguer. And the moment that ball was hit, I just felt I might have a chance of getting to it. And I had to shield my eyes against the sun as I ran out to where I thought that ball was going to be. I knew I had to run pretty fast. The center fielder had a similar notion, and we cracked heads. And both wound up in the hospital. I had a fractured skull out of it, and he had lost a whole mouthful of teeth, broke his nose and jawbones. I didn't keep up with him, but that put me out of running for quite some time.
You found that discouraging, did you?
Just disabling.
You spent a year in the hospital when you were quite young.
Yes.
In a sanitarium, as a matter of fact, right, with suspected tuberculosis. And you've said that gave you a new respect for the preciousness of life.
Well, the most interesting experiences, I think, in my life have come through illnesses. Mm-hmm. I've learned something through them. I think the most important things I've learned in my life have come as the result of illnesses. As a kid in a public sanitarium, seeing other kids around me, not all of whom got well, and some of whom had to be carried out, I naturally developed a tremendous longing for life as it might be lived outside the sanitarium. And I discovered at that time that the body has a way of finding its own way, and that the things that you want to do generally bring you where you want to go. As a kid, of 14, I think I weighed 78 pounds. And I think that's why I got into baseball. It represented a chance to do what other kids were doing. I had a quarter, 25-cent a week allowance then, as I remember it, and I would pay it to other kids to throw me grounders or bat fungos to me. And 3 years later, I discovered that I was playing reasonably good baseball and eventually played some semi-pro ball. But I owed a great debt to baseball and to the discipline it required. It's a game of split-second timing. If played correctly, you've got to put everything you've got into it. You've got to learn how to concentrate. But the desire to do that, as I say, came out of my illness. I grew very rapidly, gained a lot of weight, eventually too much of it. Then later in life, as I think you recall, 8 or 9 years ago, I had a mysterious illness that...
You just returned from the Soviet Union.
That's right. And rapidly became paralyzed. And it was systemic. There were nodules on my body, which indicated a malignancy. And once again, it became clear to me that I couldn't depend on the doctors, that this was something that I had to do for myself. And I was absolutely confident.
How did you do it for yourself?
Well, at the point that I discovered that it was serious, and I did this just by accident, by happening to see a letter that my doctor had left to another doctor whom he wanted to consult on the case. For the first time, I realized that he thought they might lose me. And then I realized I had some responsibility. I better get interested in this thing. So I thought back over the last 6 months, and it seemed to me that what had happened during that time is that I was involved in a progressive case of adrenal exhaustion, and that there was an episode in the Soviet Union when after a particularly trying time as chairman of a delegation, it was pretty frustrating, all that night there were diesel trucks passing by. It was we were on just the second floor, and the room kept filling up with this diesel smoke, and I became ill that night and insisted on coming back the next day, and that led to various symptoms. And suddenly, when I thought back, as I say, in the hospital on what had happened, I realized that these two episodes might have had something to do with it. First, the case of the adrenal exhaustion, and then second, the fact that the body, which ordinarily might have been able to meet the invasion of all those black hydrocarbons, wasn't able to do so.
So you drew upon a rational self-analysis.
And I discussed this with my doctor, who felt that it was a reasonable basis for speculation, especially since my symptoms were similar to those that are produced by heavy metal poisoning. Well, in thinking about that, I realized that there was one book that I had read, two books, in fact, that might have had a bearing on the case. One was a book by Hans Selye on stress. My wife went to the library and got the book, and there I found it, and where he talked about the problems of adrenal exhaustion, especially combined with invasion, and the problem of corticoids, and there I was seeing my symptoms. His theory, of course, was that the body undergoes negative chemical changes as the result of the negative emotions. The negative emotions being fear, frustration, stress, suppressed rage, of which I'd had a fair share. And then it seemed to me that if the body on the negative side develops a negative chemistry, that it stood to reason that on the positive side, it would produce a positive chemistry. Well, what were the positive emotions? Love, hope, faith, laughter. And not all of these were beyond my reach. And so I informed my doctor that I was going to get out, we were going to leave the hospital, because I realized that a hospital may have certain virtues, but it's no place for someone to be sick in. it just doesn't give you the repose that you need.
And the positive value that you're looking for.
And so I made some interesting discoveries. I had plenty of hope and plenty of love. As for laughter, this is something that was not beyond my means. And at night, we showed some of the funniest films that we could rent. And I made the very interesting discovery that 10 minutes of good belly laughter would give me 2 hours of pain-free sleep. Sure. And I got rid of the painkillers, the codeine, the sleeping pills. They were giving me 36 aspirin a day. And I got rid of that and went with the things that I believed in. And as I say, I discovered that that laughter did produce an actual body anesthesia. It was a very exhilarating discovery. I had a good doctor, a very good doctor, who recognized that unless the patient becomes engaged in his own cure, something serious, there's not too much he can do. Mm-hmm. This is Bill Hitzig, a great guy. Mm-hmm. And so, far from holding me back, he encouraged me. I'd known him for a long time, and he'd been exposed to some of my speculations on life and health. And then the second thing I did was to, this was before Pauling and vitamin C, it seemed to me that since there was so much inflammation in my tissues, that we did need something to meet that particular problem, and I felt that vitamin C might be worth trying for several reasons. First, it had a role to play in adrenal activity. Second, it helped to provide oxygenation for the cells in the body, two things that were clearly involved in my paralysis. And third, it would help to reduce inflammation. I asked Hitzig what the largest dose of vitamin C was that he'd ever given a patient or that he knew had been given. And at that time, this was 8 or 9 years ago, they had records of 3,000 units by injection. But as I thought about that, it didn't seem to make complete sense, because the body can absorb only so much vitamin C, and it will excrete that which it doesn't need. So it seemed to me that there might be a coefficient of time, which is how much can the body absorb in a given period of time. And so the injection system didn't seem to me to be the ideal way of doing it. And I asked Bill if he would give me vitamin C through intravenous drip, slow drip over a period of hours. But instead of giving me 3,000 units, to try experiment with 10,000 units. And we did. And then we had taken the sedimentation count, which measures your infection or inflammation, before the administration of the C. And we took it 4 hours later. And the amazing thing, as I was very excited about this, was that when we took the blood test, it showed a drop of about 8 points in the sedimentation time. Well, my sedimentation time was 115, and that is in the lethal range, and you've got to get down below 80 if you want to go on with affairs. And we did this day after day, increasing it to 12,500 the second day, 15,000, on up to 25,000 units. And day by day, the sedimentation time would drop, so I knew we were on the right track. And on the eighth day, my thumbs began to move without pain. So it was.
Then became a whole process of rediscovery.
That's right. Being able to stand up again. The first time when I stood up, it was like standing on my eyeballs. But you've got to push your body in these cases and force yourself to do things and believe that it's possible. So as I say, most of what I've learned has come about as the result of these illnesses. It's made me a happier man, perhaps.
Yes. The cure appears to be complete.
Yes, it is complete. The sedimentation time is way down to 8 or 9 to 10 or whatever.
Norman, you first went into journalism out of teacher's college. Had you intended to be a teacher?
No, I went to teacher's college at that time because it was the most exciting place intellectually in the United States. William Kilpatrick, Harold Rugg, Goodwin Watson, George Count, Engelhardt. It was full of intellectual ferment. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's interested in the natural history of ideas would feel very much at home.
And you were.
At Teachers College at that particular time. It, to me, was a vastly exciting experience. The 1930s, Teachers College would make, I think, the late 1960s seem like weak tea. Well, you probably remember it, Jim. But at that time, of course, the intellectual charge was led by the faculty and not by the students. Yes. And we had all we could do just to hang on. Mm. But here were men of courage and ideas, and they were thinking hard about life at a time when everything nailed down was coming loose, philosophically, politically, and intellectually. I stayed in touch with those men, with Kilpatrick and Rugg for many years, great teachers, great philosophers.
There was one, you've told me the story before, of a lecture at Teachers College, of one of those great teachers who raised a question that led to other questions.
Well, at Charles Beard had been asked by one of his students in his last lecture.
This was the great historian.
Yes, the great historian. Whether he could summarize everything he had learned in a lifetime of teaching in 5 minutes. And he said, I can do better than that. He said, I can tell you everything I've learned in just 4 sentences. I hope I can remember them, Jim. Mm-hmm. Number one, when it is dark enough, you can see the stars. Number two, the bee that robs the flower also fertilizes it. Number three, whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad with power. And number four, the mills of the gods grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly well.
Not a bad summary.
And so over the course of the years, I've tried to find out what other men have learned in their lifetimes and whether they could be as pithy as this, and I've put the question to
You've had a chance to meet some great men, some of the greatest.
I've been lucky in that respect. I put the question to Nehru, first telling him, of course, of the aphorisms of Charles Beard, and he listened very carefully. And he said, Mr. Beard is a lucky man. At least he thinks he's learned something. I don't know what I've learned. And then he thought for a while. He said, well, he said, maybe I have learned something. And it was taught to me by Mahatma Gandhi. He said, Gandhiji taught me that during the course of your lifetime, there are many things you're going to want to do, many things you want to achieve, many places you want to go. But just remember that the way in which you attempt to achieve these things will be more important than anything else in determining whether you actually do. Mm-hmm. The old ends and means. Schweitzer, when I put the question to him, said that he had learned that you don't have to look into the heavenly vault for evidence of the deity. You don't have to walk through the great cathedrals, though he has done that. He said, if you want to find the deity, you just sit very still and look within. Pope John the 23rd said, as Nehru did, he said, I'm not sure what I've learned. He said, but one thing I've learned is never to be afraid to reach out, hold your hand out to someone. They'll always take it. And with Khrushchev said, all those men are very long-winded. He said, I can tell you what I've learned in life in just four words. What's that? He said, never turn your back.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Norman, when you recovered, when you had this illness you have just spoken of, when you were paralyzed, you said the thing that you most feared you wouldn't be able to do again was play the organ.
Yes.
I know you play the organ. You're a self-taught musician. What brought you to the organ?
I haven't the slightest idea, but it's the thing that one of the things I most wanted to do as a kid. I wanted to go to Oberlin to study the organ and applied, but there's also Columbia here in New York and a job at the same time and a family and a depression. So I stayed here, but I never gave up that longing. You know, it was so interesting that for many years I would have these dreams about playing an organ. I would, in this dream, go into a magnificent cathedral, and I would approach the magnificent console. I would look around. No one would be there, and I would open up and start to play, and just at that precise second, someone would tap me on the shoulder and say no word. And in the second dream, I remember, I would go up to the organ. No one was around. And then suddenly, the black keys would disappear and flatten out into the white keys, and I had to figure out where the sharps and flats were. And that was frustrating. Another time, the keys turned to water. Some Freudian, I'm sure, would make a great deal of this. But then I went out and got myself an organ, and I've been sleeping soundly ever since. And I have a great deal of fun playing it. Before I die, I'd like to try to complete Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, mm-hmm. One of the great pieces, I think, written for the organ. I'm about two-thirds of the way through, and it's an ambition.
Norman, when you and I first met, it was in Japan about 25 years ago.
Yes.
And you were doing a radio documentary for ABC, and I got the impression you had never even operated the equipment before, the tape recording equipment. I think of you as one of the world's great amateurs who will undertake anything, and I think of that in connection with photography, which you've also taken up and done extremely well with, but as an amateur, a man who has a love of what he does and does it for the love of it.
Well, it's nice to try to work out the problems for yourself. Right now I'm trying to, in Arizona, working with the Questar, which is a telescope about that size, a magnificent instrument, and I've attached a camera to it, and the technical problems are indescribable. I get exhausted trying to work this thing out, because you've got the problem of the tremendous magnification of the vibrations. You've got the problem of getting enough light with all those lenses that it has to pass through. You've got the problem of having to deal without light adjustments, without an f-stop opening. And I will sit back and feel I have to go away for a week's vacation just to recoup. But I think I'm at the point now where I'm beginning to get something out of it. Mm-hmm. And just the day before yesterday, I got back my first rolls after 6 or 7 years of experimentation. I got back my first rolls where it's beginning to come through, where you see small objects with tremendous magnification, mm-hmm. not as you would under a microscope. That's a special kind of photography where you just attach the microscope to the camera to your microscope, but where you deal with ordinary objects, the bark of trees, and you see.
So it takes an enormous amount of patience.
Yes.
We have 1 minute, and I want to put a question to you. What have you learned in your lifetime?
First of all, to believe in the power of regeneration. It's difficult for me to think of any situation, whether with respect to an individual or the relationships of individuals, that cannot be regenerated, that cannot be restored. This is what led me to my present venture with the Sad Review. I think the Sad Review can be restored. This is the one great thing I've learned in my life. I think, too, I've learned that you never make a mistake in trusting. You can make a great mistake in not trusting. You have to live, of course, with the fact that your trust isn't always reciprocated. But the belief in regeneration, the sense of trust and appealing to the best in people helps to prolong life, I think, and make it a good one.
Thank you very much. Thank you.